After nearly 65 years in a state of war, now talk of peace on the Korean Peninsula.
This moment is almost a last gasp effort at any prospect for reunifying the families.
But there's still a lot standing in the way, including threats of a trade war between China and the United States. Also, a guilty verdict in the trial of three men accused of plotting to bomb a Somali community in Kansas. We talked to a leader of that community.
A lot of people, especially the elders, were very concerned about this matter. For me to call them and tell them that, yes, justice has been served, that kind of puts everybody's mind at ease.
And comedian Louis Anderson on playing Christine Baskets, a character based on his own mother.
I feel really prepared in one sense because I know the person. But in another sense, my whole goal is to make Louis Anderson completely disappear.
This is the Takeaway Podcast for Thursday, April 19th, 2018.
I look forward to meeting with Kim Jong-un, and hopefully that will be a success. We've also started talking to North Korea directly. We have had direct talks at very high levels, extremely high levels. We have not picked a site yet, but we picked five sites where it's potentially going to be. South Korea is meeting and has plans to meet with North Korea to see if they can end the war, and they have my blessing on that.
President Trump confirmed on Wednesday that CIA Director and Secretary of State nominee Mike Pompeo secretly met with Kim Jong-un to lay the groundwork for Trump's own meeting sometime in May or June. Well, the news is sprouting optimism, cautious optimism, all over Asia and the United States. Still, the cautious part is evident, even for President Trump, who wants a big deal, but is also known to quickly change his mind on what a deal looks like.
If I think that it's a meeting that is not going to be fruitful, we're not going to go. If the meeting when I'm there is not fruitful, I will respectfully leave the meeting.
North and South Korea are preparing for their two presidents to meet on April 27th. The South Korean government says the goal of that meeting should be a peace treaty. Well, is that overly optimistic, a peace treaty? What would a formal end to hostilities on the Korean Peninsula look like? Tim Shorrock is a journalist who's been covering the Korea since the 1970s. He's also a correspondent for The Nation. Tim, welcome.
Thank you.
Look, what do we know about these talks between South and North Korea right now and what the real goal is?
The real goal is to get a peace process going in Korea that ends the Korean War, gets a peace treaty, and moves to a position where North Korea can normalize its relationships with the United States and end its nuclear program. And they've been talking about this for weeks now, and I think this is a momentous event coming up in South Korea.
Well, why is this all happening now? What do you think is driving this behind the scenes?
Well, what drove it was, you know, obviously last year, as we know, the North Koreans tested, 11 or 12 missiles, and they have an ICBM capable of hitting the United States, and they also have nuclear weapons. They haven't quite placed those nuclear weapons on an ICBM that can travel through the atmosphere and hit a target in the United States yet, but they're close. But the point is, at the end of the year last year, they stopped their tests before they reached that full nuclear capability and signaled that they were ready to talk. And so I think they feel like they're going into any negotiations with the U.S. from a position of strength. And on January 1st, Kim Jong-un made a declaration, made a speech where he said to the South Koreans he wanted to engage again. And Moon Jae-in, the president of South Korea, immediately followed that up. And they had the most high-level negotiations, since the end of the Korean War after that. And so, they've been laying the groundwork for these upcoming talks that begin next week. And I think those talks are going to lay the groundwork for the Trump-Kim summit later in May or early June.
You know, Tim, we tell ourselves all the time here in the United States that a tough approach to North Korea can yield fruit in terms of negotiations. If you get tough on them, they'll come to the table. You're suggesting quite the opposite. You're suggesting maybe that North Korea and Kim Jong-un, through its nuclear testing and missile testing, got pretty tough and made it clear that the South and maybe the United States should come to the table.
I think that's absolutely true. And, they've been saying for years what they want. They're building their nuclear weapons as a deterrence against the United States. And so they wanted to at least have the capability to have that that deterrence in the sense of hitting U.S. bases. What they have now, they could easily hit U.S. bases in Japan and Okinawa and South Korea. So they wanted that deterrence, wanted to come in with that. But I do think that the sanctions have definitely played a role here. The very heavy sanctions imposed by the United States as well as the United Nations. They may not be stopping or slowing down their rocket or missile or nuclear program there, but they've certainly beginning to pinch the North Korean economy. And one of the things that Kim Jong-un has said over and over again is that he wants to start focusing on building the North Korean economy. So I think, they're very anxious to lift these sanctions.
Tim, China and the United States are both intimately involved here, not just politically, but are both parties to the initial war declaration and to the armistice. So China and the U.S. would both have to sign off here, right? There are increasing trade tensions between China and the United States now. Can you connect those tensions to what might happen if we go around a couple corners on the Korean Peninsula?
I actually don't think the trade tensions with China will play much of a role here. I think China's quite committed, wants a peace process to begin and wants, a settlement of the issues on the Korean Peninsula, regardless of what happens on trade. And I think that actually what happened over the last year, and especially with Moon Jae-in, the president of South Korea, playing such a prominent role in this diplomacy, is that actually, the U.S. kind of wanted China to play a big role in getting North Korea to get into a negotiating mode. But actually, it was South Korea that played that mediator role. And actually, it's going to be South Korea that's going to be mediating between the United States and North Korea as opposed to China. So, China's kind of watching this from the sidelines, which is why, of course, they invited, Kim Jong-un to visit China a couple of weeks ago because they wanted to make sure they were on, they had a clear idea of what was going to happen. They were in agreement with what should happen. But I do think that it really is South Korea's president, Moon Jae-in, who's primarily responsible for this major shift.
So, Tim, let's talk about incentives here before we go. Does peace with the South really mean peace with the United States, though, from the perspective of North Korea? I mean, opposing the American invader, fighting the aggressor, all of that has been pretty critical propaganda and a major pillar of the structure of the North Korean regime. Would they give it up?
Well, they say they're willing to denuclearize and they're willing to talk about denuclearization issues. But I think, on the other side, we have to look at, they've been wanting the U.S. to end its hostile policy. I mean, the United States has had until 1991, had nuclear weapons in South Korea, pulled them out, but they've got nuclear weapons, all over in their region, in Japan, in Okinawa, and in Guam. And so, North Korea sees that as a threat. So I think, both sides need to come to the table with an idea of ending the enmity between them. And I think that's what's very possible here.
Tim Shorrock, correspondent for The Nation, longtime observer and journalist covering the Koreas. Tim, great to have you. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
Let's move now to what a possible peace treaty could mean for families who were split between North and South during the Korean War. Catherine Killo is a fellow at the Plowshares Fund and a young Korean American who's advocated for peace between North and South. And I asked her how different generations in Korea are feeling about these latest developments.
I don't want to paint the South Korean public with a broad brush. I think it's really split among ideological lines, party affiliations. I can speak for my mother's generation, and I would say my mother's family comes from a more blue-collar Korean upbringing. And for her, this is a really emotional and personal issue. So you could put her in the idealistic, optimistic camp. On the other hand, there are, for good reason, plenty of Korean families who are extremely skeptical. They're accustomed to these gestures. There have been talks of reunifying families in the past that have fallen through, or only a small nominal amount of families were able to meet. So it's definitely split, and it's not an easy question to answer in any simple way. And I think that also goes with when you look at the young Korean generations and how they feel about this whole initiative.
We'll talk about younger people in South Korea, in North Korea, if you can. I mean, we've had other analysts on this show who've suggested that with all the fire and fury between North Korea and the United States, that a lot of younger people in South Korea in particular aren't terribly engaged with this conflict and with the North. They kind of go about their lives, and it is a generalization, but they don't think about it much.
Based on my own assessments and personal conversations I've had with friends who are my age in Korea, I'd say it is largely the case that young people there are more skeptical than they are jazzed about a peace treaty or any sort of engagement effort with North Korea. But I don't believe that's coming from a place of hate or aversion toward North Korea as it is indifference. These are people who have been living their whole lives accustomed to the reality that is a nuclear North Korea that's provocative from time to time, has a rather colorful leader. And that being said, there's still this powerful sense of familial attachment and identity as one people. So, you know, I think there are a lot of legitimate anxieties that the youth have towards North Korea, but at the same time, it's just so complicated by this idea that, you know, the people on the other side of the border are still your brothers and sisters.
Well, what about you, Catherine? You're a young Korean-American, part of the diaspora. How do you feel about the end to the state of war and a potential peace treaty now?
I'm extremely encouraged by it. For me, it's helpful to frame this idea of a peace treaty as the start to a process. And to see it, you know, I think there is a tendency to view peace treaty as reunification. But that's not the case, because this is actually just a commitment to end hostilities and to actually move forward on an issue that has divided the country arbitrarily for nearly a century.
Still, I mean, you hear President Trump just yesterday saying, if these talks aren't fruitful, I'll walk away. It seems like everybody, even President Trump, understands the fragility of what's going on here.
Definitely. But I think President Trump is also the type of president who really wants a victory. So I'm actually more optimistic that no matter what happens at the summits, he is going to consider this a win. And maybe he'll just leave it at that and let the negotiators take control. But in any case, this is a better outcome than what we've been doing previously.
Catherine Killow, a young Korean-American and a fellow at the Plowshares Fund. Catherine, thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Let's head to Cuba now, where after 12 years, Raul Castro has stepped down as president. Today, a new president was elected in a Cuban election with only one candidate. Communist Party loyalist Miguel Díaz-Canel is Cuba's next president and the first non-Castro to lead that country since the revolution in 1959. Canel has avoided the spotlight during his long government career, so that's raised the question, what will Canel's Cuba look like after 60 years of Fidel and then Raul Castro? Lillian Guerra is here to help us make sense of the transition in Cuba. She's professor of Latin American and Caribbean history at the University of Florida. Her latest book is Heroes, Martyrs, and Political Messiahs in Revolutionary Cuba. Dr. Guerra, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Well, 60 years, the Castro's step aside. Is this still La Revolución?
Well, first of all, I don't think he's really stepping aside. I mean, Raul is mostly concerned about continuity of his policies and stability of the state as it currently exists. And that's precisely why he has made this move. I mean, it appears to be much more than it is. It's much more a move about containing what will be, I think, tremendously unpopular responses, or rather, tremendous responses to unpopular policy shifts that Díaz-Canel is going to have to carry out in the next several years.
Now, you're suggesting that Díaz-Canel is handpicked and that Raul Castro maintains power behind the scenes.
Yeah, I mean, Raul remains not just behind the scenes. He's the head of the armed forces. That means that he has not just military power in his hands, but the armed forces actually control 80% of the Cuban economy. They have the largest capitalist conglomerate in their hands called Gesa, which owns Gaviota, which in turn is the largest tourist company in Cuba. So they control all the foreign investment in Cuba. The army is basically the head of the economy, and Raul is the CEO of that. He is also going to remain head of the Communist Party, and he announced Díaz-Canel would be his successor in 2013. So this is not a big surprise to anyone. On the other hand, what I think is happening is that, as I said earlier, or I mentioned earlier, Díaz-Canel is going to be the face of certain policy shifts that Raul and his economists or his advisors say must take place in order for this communist-led capitalist regime to survive. And those are going to have terrible impacts on the Cuban people. So I think that Díaz-Canel in some ways is a fall guy, or going to be a fall guy. It allows this shift, or this transition as it appears to be, allows for Castro to deflect blame for those policy shifts that are coming down the road and that have already been announced. In fact, they've provoked quite a bit of fear and trepidation on the part of Cubans.
Now, what about the economic situation up until this moment? There was a warming of relations, of course, with the United States, some economic reforms in Cuba, and then some of those seem to snap back.
Well, since 1992, the Cuban state adopted state capitalism, really, which means that it created a kind of neoliberal model of development that's very common in the Caribbean, where you have free trade zones, foreign investors bringing in all that is needed to basically create assembly plants and take advantage of very, very cheap labor. The state manages those free trade zones, and we also have the state managing and owning most of the tourist economy. And so the state is reliant on capitalism despite the fact that it's a communist government.
Professor, you mentioned Miguel Díaz-Canel as just the face of some economic reforms and potentially the fall guy for difficult decisions and unpopular decisions that are coming to Cuba. Talk more about that. Surely he's aware of his position in relation to Raul Castro. Difficult times coming for Cuba.
Yes. I mean, Díaz-Canel is the survivor, really, almost the lone survivor of several of very prominent people of his generation who were about the same age and were very important to the capitalist reforms of the 1990s. Most of those guys who occupied very high positions in government, including Carlos Laje, who was vice president for most of the last 30 years. Raul got rid of him. He got rid of Felipe Perez Roque, who was minister of foreign relations between 1999 and 2009, and Díaz-Canel, because he was head of operations for the party, we can say provincially, was off stage and was brought into the center of power by Raul because he is something of a yes man to Raul. He has stated in August in a meeting of the party, which leaked to the press, that he is very committed to censorship. He's very committed to censoring the internet, which is one of the main means by which the citizenry is able to block the monopoly that the state has over the press and over ideas. But more importantly, Raul has been announcing since 2011 two major policy shifts that are economic in nature and that will devastate in many respects the stability of Cuba's Cubans' daily lives. So one is that he has announced that there will need to be an end to the ration. And this is rationing of foods, which have still continued since 1962, still continue to provide Cubans with most of their calories. He called that, Raul did, a millionaire subsidy back in 2011. And so the ending of the ration system is something that is down the pike, and Díaz-Canel is going to have to carry that out. And then also, in a more complex way than we would expect, the economy operates based on a dual currency system. So the tourist zones and the free trade zones, the assembly plants that are run by the state with foreign investment, they receive money in hard currency, but they pay their workers in a local currency called the peso. And that trades at more or less a 1 to 25 ratio with the U.S. dollar. So most Cubans are earning about 10 to at most $30 a month, which is not enough to survive on. And what Raul has announced repeatedly, in fact, in 2013, when he announced that his successor would be Díaz-Canel, he also announced that there would be a merging of the dual currency systems into one currency. And that will reveal, for how poor Cubans really are, if they are actually paying for things only in dollars and there is no subsidizing, we could say, of the economy through this means of paying Cubans in pesos and having certain items priced in pesos. Once you get rid of that, then you're really going to have a very impoverished economy, and there isn't going to be a way to hide that poverty. It's going to become more intense, and Díaz-Canel will be the face of that process. So to me, this is all about deflecting blame from the Castros and preserving their legacy. It's also a way by which Raúl, who is head of the military, will ensure that you have a kind of non-monolithic state. You know, that Díaz-Canel will carry out these policies, and if there is major blowback for them, then the other parts of the state, like the military, don't take the blame. The party doesn't appear to be taking the blame. It's the, you know, president of the Council of State who's carrying out these policies. And if there is protest, then Raúl could easily repress the protest and replace Díaz-Canel with himself and appear to be coming back, returning, as a sort of patron of the people, which he has never been.
Lillian Guerra predicts difficult times, maybe even crisis times ahead for Cuba, and says that Miguel Díaz-Canel, new president of Cuba, might be the face and the fall guy of difficult reforms coming down the pike. Lillian Guerra, professor of Caribbean history at the University of Florida, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Takeaway Podcast. If you like what you're hearing, give us a rating and review us on iTunes. Also, tell your friends. Share this podcast on Facebook or Twitter or wherever you want your followers to get some solid news coverage. They'll be smarter. They'll think you're a hero. It's a win-win. Now back to the show.
A federal jury on Wednesday in Kansas brought an end to the trial that rocked the Somali community in Garden City, Kansas. Three men convicted of plotting to bomb an apartment complex where Somali immigrants lived and worked is a thriving center for the Somali community there. We've been following this case closely, and now with a verdict, we turn to Ifra Ahmed. She's a refugee from Somalia and a leader in the Somali community in Garden City. Ifra, welcome to The Takeaway.
It's my pleasure.
Ifra, what was your reaction when you heard news of this verdict yesterday?
Very pleased, very, very pleased indeed. We had some doubts of what would be coming out. You never know what the final say it's going to be, but we also had faith at the same time. And the faith is that we knew at the end of the day, regardless of what happens, what is right is going to come out and justice is going to be served. And now people can finally move on.
Now, what happened when you relayed this news to some of the older members of the community or people who weren't necessarily on social media watching for the verdict?
It was very relieving because a lot of people, especially the elders, were very concerned about this matter. They were very pleased to hear because not so long ago, about last week, we had a council meeting and we talked about it and we had decided to just pray on it and see what happens next. Now, well, I received a call and I was told that the verdict came out and they have been charged. For me to call them and tell them that, yes, justice has been served, that kind of puts everybody's mind at ease.
Well, I mean, a lot of attention has been heaped on your community for all the wrong reasons for these last many months. What was the experience of this trial like for the community that you help lead with investigators, with police, with the media and all of the attention that's been focused on Garden City?
It is. It's been an intense moment. And I'm just glad that we have overcome that period of time. And it made us stronger as a community, not only the Somali community or the refugee community, but Garden City in general as a community. It enabled us to come together and work together to come through this process.
What was the relationship like with the police during this time?
Impeccable. The police have come a long way to help us a long way. They were there for support in case of anything, if we needed anything, if we had concerns, if we had questions, we were able to go to them and they would answer it for us. And you don't always find that everywhere. They didn't see us as just people that were just staying there for a temporary time or what people had thought at that time, but they seen us as a community, as a part of the community, and they were there during the crisis. If we had questions, the chief of police would meet with the elders monthly, regularly. He would ask if we had concerns, if what was going on, if we had any problems. And how often do you see that where the chief of police is communicating with the community elders and asking them what's going on, if they need this and that? So it was kind of, we all came together as a community, we including the police, the elders, the rest of the people in Garden City.
Still, there must have been a sense of dread that this plot was hatched in the first place. Ifra, can you take me back to several months ago when you and others first heard that these three men had been caught plotting to bomb your community and kill a lot of people?
Oh, of course, they have been a dread. It was very shocking and unexpected, because when refugees come to the U.S., all they're trying to do is reestablish another life. It's resettlement and make an honest living, go to work, do their best. Now, when you hear that you became a target, that is just, it's extremely terrifying, knowing that, okay, now that this is my new home, I might have to leave again. I came here to build a new home, and now I'm not sure if I can even stay here.
I mean, did it make you question why you came to America in the first place? Surely to leave your home in Somalia, there must have been very good reasons to leave. You come to a new place with opportunity and wind up facing potential violence here.
And it was extremely stressful and scary, the thought of having to start all over again, because to us, this is home. It was our new home. It's what we called home now, and we lived here. And now we had to find somewhere else. We have to go somewhere else. We have to go and find another home.
I mean, how far along did those conversations get in the community? Were people making plans to leave or talking about where they might go?
They were. A lot of people were making plans to leave, and people were, well, when that happened, a lot of people's children didn't go to school the next day. So every person was contemplating how are we leaving? Where are we going to go next? What's our next step? Now, thankfully, that didn't happen. Right away, the police department got involved. They had a meeting with all the community, and they explained what was going on. And a lot of times what people need is to be shown that they care. If you show people that we care about you, people will stay.
And now that the verdict has come back from the jury and the verdict is guilty, these three men going to prison, presumably, do people who were talking about leaving, do they feel more comfortable staying now?
Right now, people are trying to move on from what happened, because it is kind of a trigger to be constantly be reminded of. Now, with the verdict happening, it enables people to move on. Justice has been served. We can move on from this. There is no that what if chance.
Now, Ifra, what about you? You're a leader in that community. Has the whole experience changed how you see your role?
It showed me that no matter what happens, we can come together as a community. We can overcome all the obstacles. And I believe it also helped me grow as a person. It helped me grow as a leader. And also it made me realize how much love there is in a small town and how kind people can be and how people can come together in the midst of crisis.
Ifra, we're very glad that everyone in your community is all right. And that your community was able to come together in a very difficult time. So thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Ifra Ahmed is a leader in the Somali community in Garden City, Kansas.
And my mom makes too much. She's always overcooking, like 700 or 800 pounds of sweet potatoes. So she's got to push it during the meal. They're sweet potatoes. They're hot. There's more in the oven. Some in the garage.
Actor and comedian Louis Anderson has been making audiences laugh with his stand-up for decades. Like there in the late 80s, you can also see him popping up in classic American comedies like Coming to America. But today, a lot of people know Louis Anderson for his Emmy-winning performance as the mom of rodeo clown Zach Galifianakis on the FX show Baskets.
What's that?
It's marijuana, madame. We will smoke it outside.
Oh, no. Is that the same as grass?
Yes.
Do you mind if I give it a try?
What?
Sure, yeah.
Wait a second, yeah. Mom. No.
What?
You're weird enough. Mom, don't do that.
I don't take orders from you anymore, Chip. I'm out of the rodeo.
Louis Anderson there as Christine Baskets. Louis says he's been channeling his mother in his acting for years. She died in 1990, but Louis still has things to tell her. So he's written a book. It's called Hey Mom, Stories for My Mother, But You Can Read Them Too, and it's out this month. One of the things that Louis Anderson tells his mom about is playing Mrs. Baskets.
First, they said, would you do a part on his sitcom? And I go, yes. They go, would you play his mother? I go, yes, I'll do it. Because I knew, you know, I've been doing my mom and my act for a lot of years, but also I knew I had an opportunity to play something really different and original, and I guess I didn't exactly know how I was going to play it, but I did know I wasn't going to play it like anyone else has ever played a woman. I already knew that immediately. I said, I'm going to do something special with this part somehow.
And did the producers of the show, the writers, did they know, oh, Louis plays his mom in his act, and that's the kind of mom we want him to channel that for this role? Did they come to you with that very idea?
Zach had a woman, she was the first choice for him, for mother. But he made a noise in the room, and somebody else, I think Louis C.K. said, you mean Louis Anderson, because it sounded like me? And Zach said yes. And then Zach later told me he always had it in mind to have me play his mother. He said it was always in his head to have me play his mother.
Louis C.K. was an executive producer on that show for the first 2 years at least, right?
Yeah.
So what do you think about what's happened with Louis, with his behavior, with his apology, his sort of retreat from comedy, and all of the recriminations that have come from that? I mean, you know him well.
Well, I mean, I never really knew Louis before that, just so you're clear. I never really knew Louis. I mean, but I enjoyed Louis. I worked with him, and I thought the whole thing that happened, it still is, it's upsetting to me. And, you know, it's unfortunate for everyone involved. And it's sad to me that when I bring up, you know, when I got the job, that's then goes right there, that I can't do the interview. And I'm not pointing this at you, I'm just saying in general, that I have to go and dredge all that up again. You know, because I thought Louis, you know, did a really admirable thing by stepping away right now, and also by making a really honest, what felt like, you know, very honest apology.
Well, let's move back then to the show itself, to Baskets. Is there anything hard about playing the mother of Zach Galifianakis, about playing a woman? I mean, you've been channeling your mom for so many years in your own act, as you've said. Is it easy to just slip into that skin now?
It is a little different than the person I play on stage, but I did have a, you know, kind of the person I pulled from. She's who I'm doing when I'm up there. I think of my mom, I think of Orzel Anderson, I think of the way she did little tiny things and big things and raised our family. And I use all those nuances. There are tons of them with my mom. She could have been an actress herself. I feel really prepared in one sense because I know the person. But in another sense, my whole goal is to make Louis Anderson completely disappear and not to play this character cartoony.
But Louis, your own mom and your channeling of her, I mean, did I read right? 9 brothers and sisters, 10 including you?
Actually, 10 brothers and sisters, 11 including me.
Gosh, okay.
I mean, 10th of 11.
And still, Louis, it's clear that you managed to feel very loved by her. That didn't seem to be a problem in terms of your relationship with her.
No, she was inexhaustible as a human being, and especially as a mother. She was the hen of all hens, the duck of all ducks, who had all of her chicks following her and falling in a grate, and then she would stand there till somebody helped get the chick out of the sewer. I mean, when I get to play a mother, and that's how this book started, because I said, Mom, I have questions. I need answers. How did you do it? How did you do it? I see people with 3 kids at the airport and they're having a breakdown. How did you have 11 children? Did you do a head count every day at the beginning and the end of the day? How many pancakes is that? You know, it's more than a dozen eggs, unless we're a one egg family. And by the looks of us, we're not.
Have you found answers for these questions?
A lot of them, because my brothers and sisters helped me with a lot of them. But, you know, and then it jogged my memory, and I went back, and I searched, and I found, and I dredged up all the memories that I had of those situations, you know, cleaning, you know, vegetables with my mom. I was her sidekick in the kitchen and helping her, and the generosity of my mom and dad when we go grocery shopping at Country Club Market, that two bags were set aside and we would drop them on the porches of people who were struggling at the time. Even though we were struggling and poor, there was always charity in my house. I learned so much from them, and I wanted to highlight it in the book, but I also wanted to say to people, be sure if your family, your mom, your dad are alive, ask them the questions. You know, like I would have loved to ask my mom, what did you see in dad? What was the magic that you would stay with this monster that long? What was it like? You know, she lost a couple of children along with the children she had. How did she survive that? I mean, you know, when I walked up on the stage to get the Emmy the first year for Baskets, I said, we did it, Mom, because really it's as much her award as it is anyone else's. And so I just wanted her to get her due. Sometimes, you know, people don't get it when they're alive, but I wanted to make sure that she was known by as many people as possible as a really kind, smart, funny, and a little bit crazy human being.
You know, so many people listening to this, we both know this, Louis, are far more disappointed in their parents or unsure, uneasy about their own upbringing than you are, certainly. One of 11 siblings. I mean, I just have to say that it sounds like you were incredibly lucky.
I agree.
Not only, to have such an attentive and loving mom and dad, too.
Would you say that you're disappointed?
With my parents?
Yeah.
Oh, no, quite the opposite. No,
yeah,
Louis,
that's what I mean. Yeah.
But we both know that a lot of people are, and it damages them.
Yeah, it does damage them. You know, the other thing is circumstances, you know. My parents weren't perfect. My dad, I had to forgive. He was a raging alcoholic, a monster. But his alcoholism did all that damage because the human being who quit drinking, the human being I found out about afterwards and the way he was raised, he had done much better. You know, so it's circumstances. It's like my mom always said, be nice to people because you never know what kind of day they've had. Mm-hmm. You know, she had this thing where she had this, you know, and this is one of the characteristics of Christine. It's one of the characteristics of Christine Baskets, her humanity, her empathy, her understanding. It's big and it's important for me, to carry those out because I learned all that humanity from my mom.
I don't know, Louis, how did you get so successful as a comic with this much empathy? Comics come through, I love them all, and believe me, I'm a fan of the cynics. I love that stuff. I'm not saying I don't. You wouldn't necessarily tell a young comic to approach the world with a big heart and so much empathy and sympathy. People don't want to hear that on stage, you know?
Maybe. Well, you know, I had these great characters like my dad, you know. He never hit us. He carried a gun. That's the kind of jokes that I told. He never shot us. He'd just go. He just would click it. Very effective. You know, so I painted those things. But, you know, what I was always trying to do, I finally figured out, is to bring the family together. And that's why my act is clean, because you can bring your mom, you can bring your grandma, you can bring your kids of a certain age. So I think as a comic, I found my way to this. I still, you know, people say, well, how can you talk about all that stuff and still be funny? I go, well, come and watch me, because I'm not doing a soft act. I'm doing an act that has a lot of bite to it and a lot of punch to it, but I'm not biting or punching anybody that I don't know.
Louis Anderson, actor, portrayer of Christine Baskets on FX and author of Hey Mom, Stories from My Mother. But you can read them too. Louis, it's been great. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much.
Well, that's all for us today. Hey, we always want to hear from you. Join the conversation on our Facebook page. You can send your thoughts to us on Twitter, at The Takeaway, and you can find me there too. I'm at Todd Zwillick. Thanks so much for listening. I am Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.